This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
I'm Willie Edwards, pretty much a lifetime resident of Uvalde, Texas. I've lived here ever since I was one, and I'm proud to say I'm 70 now. So I was actually at a restaurant 20 miles from town with a friend and his wife, who my friend had back surgery today. He's doing well. And as we were leaving the restaurant, a friend of mine, former teacher, said that she just got a text that there was an active shooter at Robb, that maybe a teacher had been killed. And my wife and I, you know, just drove towards Robb Elementary, and it became obvious that it was something really bad was going on. Lots of ambulances. And then the tolls started coming in. 14 children dead, 18 children dead, 19 children dead, 2 adults, 3 adults. We're just learning what all's involved, who all's involved. You know, I just found out, you know, my wife has a former student whose daughter was one of the ones killed. And the last picture they took of her was holding her certificate for being in the all AB honor row. They had an awards program yesterday at Robb Elementary. And to see that beaming face with all that possibility and hope and joy, and to know it's not here anymore, is pretty damn painful. And it's going to be painful for a while. You know, I had a cousin that texted me, and it was yesterday, and it was like, "Do you know anybody that's been affected?" And I love my cousin, but that was one of the stupider things I've ever had to ask me, because we're all affected. But when I heard Kim, somebody that I know personally and that I've seen and know is such a joyful person, to know that her daughter, that I know she loved as much as anybody's ever loved a daughter, was dead. I'll never get over that moment. And her best friend is the editor of the paper, and they could go in and hug her and shake in each other's arms and cry. And there's nothing that can be said. Nothing. You just show up. You know, the greatest thing about Uvalde is the people. You know, this community has meant so much to me. It's, you know, my parents died when I was young, and this community held me up. And I can tell you that today is the saddest day that Uvaldians hopefully will ever feel.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's all I got.
I'm so sorry.
No, I know you are. And I appreciate, you know, it's...
That's Willie Edwards, and he spoke with our contributor Rachel Monroe, who's reporting for The New Yorker from Uvalde, Texas. Now, on Tuesday of last week, I called up two researchers who wrote a study of people who commit mass killings. The book is called The Violence Project, and they run a research institute on the subject. I wanted to talk with them about the shooting in Buffalo, because it seemed to me that after a week, a stunning horror was already being forgotten. One more mass killing on a long historical list. That was the middle of the morning on Tuesday the 24th. We recorded our conversation, and before my producer had even edited the interview, a teenager walked into an elementary school in Texas carrying an assault rifle. Without a doubt, politicians need to act to reduce gun violence, but we also need, all of us, to understand better what's going on. Why the number of mass killings in America has increased like this? And what motivates someone to target children or grocery store customers at the cost of their own life or their life outside of prison? So I got back on the phone later in the week with the scholars who run the Violins Project, James Densley of Metropolitan State University and Gillian Peterson of Hamline University. Gillian and James, I really don't know what to say. 2 days ago, we were talking about the horrible shooting in a grocery store in Buffalo. And now here we are again in the aftermath of another horrific shooting, this time in Texas. It's beyond reckoning. You've studied mass shooters stretching back to the University of Texas, so-called the Tower shooting in 1966. When you look at the events of the past 2 weeks, what are you seeing that we don't?
I think I see the same story playing out over and over and over and over again. It follows the same trajectories, the sort of slow build over time, the hate, the online radicalization, the leaking plans and telling people they're going to do it, the easy access to firearms, the young 18-year-old kid. It just is the same story over and over again. It feels like we really should be able to take action at this point.
Let's take our time with this. Take us through what typically leads someone to do something like this, whether it's in a grocery store or a school or wherever.
Yeah, so we started this project building a database just to sort of track the numbers of these mass shootings. But then we started to dive deeper into the life histories of the shooters themselves, everything from their childhood, their mental health history, how they got access to firearms, their motivations. We have interviewed perpetrators. We've interviewed families who've lost loved ones. We've gone back and spoke to survivors of these shootings, people who were there, eyewitnesses, first responders. So we see this trajectory toward violence that's very common among these mass shooters. It often starts with some sort of early childhood trauma. These are individuals who have experienced something in their lives that has never really been resolved. And related to that, at some point, they reach this identifiable crisis point that this feeling overwhelms their usual coping mechanisms. And they get to a point in life where they no longer care if they live or die. And so it's often a suicidal crisis, but it's also an angry crisis. There's somebody there to blame. They're trying to make sense of their lives. And in doing so, they then look for models of behavior. They start to research other mass shooters, other people who felt just like them. And they start to identify with those individuals and realize, well, maybe it's not me that's the problem. Maybe it's them that's the problem. Maybe society is to blame. Maybe it's black people to blame. Maybe it's my school teachers to blame. Whoever it is that I can focus on. And often during that point, by the way, people are posting on social media, posting online. They're talking about doing this. The warning signs are all there.
Why does this happen in the United States with real frequency? And when it happens abroad, it is a freak, an outlier. What distinguishes, to use that word, the United States?
I think there's a couple answers to that question. The first one just being how easily we can access firearms, and the sheer number of firearms is really different. I was talking to, I believe it was the BBC yesterday, and sort of an international reporter, and they could not fathom the fact that we run our children through drills in case this happens. That was such a foreign concept to them. Their minds were blown. That's the extent that which we've normalized this in America. For me, it was really this moment of like, my God, what are we doing, right? We've just accepted this. And so I think there's also this social contagion piece where one happens, somebody gets a lot of fame and notoriety for it. We do nothing. We make no policy changes. And then another person comes right behind them. They do tend to cluster like this, which is why we weren't particularly surprised to see another horrific mass shooting right on the tails of Buffalo.
What's also interesting about the rise of mass shootings is it maps onto a rise in what we also call deaths of despair. Deaths of despair, these are deaths, suicides, drug and alcohol overdoses. These are at record highs right now in the United States, as are mass shootings. And we ask ourselves, are mass shootings a form of death of despair? It's something we write about in the second chapter of our book, where we're trying to explore what is it that makes America different. And yes, it's prevalence of firearms, but there's something deeper. There's something deeper in American culture and American society, our lack of a social safety net, the way in which we are sort of organized as individuals in this society as opposed to a collective. And these deaths of despair and these mass shootings, they seem to be related.
Yeah, that was one thing that struck me early on, is I hadn't thought of these mass shootings as a form of suicide. Of course, it's a horrific homicide, but the perpetrator goes in with no escape plan. It's never like that I'm going to leave and race for the border. It's I'm going to either be killed, kill myself, or spend the rest of my life in prison. And that's the goal. That's the plan. And so what we can learn from suicide prevention, I think, can teach us about how to prevent some of these mass shootings. We haven't connected those two things, but when we think of these as suicides, in addition to being homicides, as a form of a death of despair, it actually opens up a lot of new prevention ways forward.
Now, the Buffalo shooter was completely up to his hips in white supremacy material online, a believer in replacement theory, which is the idea that a kind of genocide, a political demographic genocide, is being perpetrated on white people. Now, you say that ideology is not at the root of mass shootings. How can that possibly be true in the case of something like what happened in Buffalo?
I think what we try to think about here is, what is it that makes somebody susceptible to that type of a conspiracy theory and to that type of propaganda in the first place? Because nobody who's living a fulfilled life finds this material compelling, so much so that it would motivate them to want to commit murder. Now, that material maybe gave that person some sort of meaning, and it perhaps facilitated the crime that followed. It gave them a pathway to move forward. But we don't think of it necessarily as quite as causal as sometimes is referenced in the sort of popular media, because we often search for motive. And then when we find that motive, we are able to put these mass shooters in a little box. We're able to say, well, that was a terrorist, or that was a hate crime, or it was a gang member, or whatever brand we can give it. We make it sound like these are these scary monsters that aren't actually our children, our community members, people that we know, our neighbors. That prevents us from looking out when the warning signs are abundantly clear. When somebody's there on social media posting this stuff, somebody needs to pay attention. And if we absolve ourselves of that responsibility, this is going to keep happening again and again and again.
Who's that somebody?
It's everyone, I would say. It's everyone from family members, friends, teachers, police, coworkers. What we see time and time again is that these perpetrators tell people they're going to do this. They post about it. School shooters in particular, it's over 80% of them tell other people. We call it leakage. The most common people they tell is their classmates. You know, we've studied school shootings where 50, 60 kids knew it was going to happen and nobody told any adults in the building. And then even when adults do get told, we're not sure what to do with that information, right? The police check it out. They say, oh, maybe he doesn't have guns right at this moment, so there's nothing we can do. And then we move on, rather than having systems in place at the school to say, this is a kid who's not okay. This is a kid who has to be connected with long-term services with continual follow-up.
I want to ask specifically about the shooting in Texas, the targeting of kids, of children. It's incomprehensible, and yet it's not unique to the Uvalde shooting. What could possibly motivate a person, even a person who's experienced trauma, who was suicidal, who'd been radicalized, indoctrinated? What would drive a person to kill kids in grade school?
It's unreal. I'm a parent of three kids. My oldest is in fourth grade, so this has just been so gutting. What's kind of different, actually, about this shooting is that when we look at school mass shootings, over 90% of them typically target their own school, either their current school or a former school. They typically are angry at their classmates and at their teachers and at their peers. So targeting an elementary school, of course, it happened in Sandy Hook, but it is very rare. You know, it's possible that something happened to him in elementary school that he still carries anger from. I think that will emerge. But what we do know is, sadly, when you target elementary school kids, it makes huge headlines, right? You make the history books. And so it could be that sort of fame and notoriety seeking. But
that's the point, the fame and notoriety of killing children.
We see that. It's the wanting to be known for something in doing something like this in a way that you were never going to be known in life. It is. It's wanting to make the headlines and have your face everywhere.
Now, this may be outside the scope of your scholarly research. And I must say, it stuns me that you're really the first ones to come along and do research of this kind and at this depth, considering the problem involved here. But when I listen to Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, when I listen to Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, talking about this, rushing to the fore, saying we should not come to any untoward political conclusions, and yet again, you know, the same cycle of rhetoric. What conclusion do you draw about our politics?
Well, one thing we've tried really hard to do in our work is come at it in this nonpartisan, really data-driven ways. So when we come up with solutions, when we say universal background checks, when we say red flag laws, when we say permit to purchase or raise the age limit, those aren't political statements. Those are data-driven. That is what the data tells us. Those things will save lives. There's nothing political about that. It's simply the science. And many countries have shown us the way. We have the evidence. So the idea that that is political, that to me is the bothersome piece of this.
We try to organize solutions to mass shootings in our book on three levels. One at the individual level, which is what could I do tomorrow as a regular citizen to try and prevent a mass shooting? And that might just be something as simple as, if I have a gun in the home, lock it up, safe storage. What can we do as institutions, at schools, workplaces, to prevent a mass shooting? Can we do more to be attuned to the behavioral warning signs that somebody is on the pathway to violence? Can we intervene earlier? Can we get them connected to the help that they need? And then there is the societal piece, and I think that's what we're talking about here. And that's where a lot of the effort has often been placed, is talking around how do we get politicians to act. The challenge is we don't want that to hold us up, to start to make small steps that can actually make a big difference. And that's what our research is telling us. We can't grow numb to this.
But I swear to God, it seems that we have. After Charleston, there was an outpouring of emotion, and it went on for days, and there were story after story after story. And after Buffalo, after 2 days, it was gone. Now, maybe with the killing of children, it'll last a few days longer, and then it'll be gone. What changes the damn equation?
I mean, I'll be honest. I wish I knew. I think we've done this research. We've written the book. We know the pathway forward. It is there. We know what we need to do to stop this, and we choose not to do it. We've been doing it wrong for a long time, right? For a long time, we thought, okay, let's harden our schools and let's arm our teachers and let's run our kids through drills. That all failed. That was the wrong approach. We now know we need to soften our schools. We need to make them welcoming and open, and we need to get guns out of there. And now we just need people to do it. I don't know how we keep ourselves from getting numb and how we stay this sad and this angry to push this through.
James Densley teaches criminal justice at Metropolitan State University in Minnesota. And Jillian Peterson teaches forensic psychology at Hamline University in St. Paul. Kianga Yamada Taylor wrote about the attack in Buffalo, New York, just a couple of weeks ago, when a white gunman killed 10 people at a grocery store in a predominantly black neighborhood in that city. She's a regular contributor, as well as a historian at Princeton University. Kianga, I just spoke with Jillian Peterson and James Densley, who are researchers who have made a big study of mass shootings, and they've concluded that while bigotry and prejudice are motivating factors in many of these shootings, they're not necessarily the root cause. They suggest that a person first reaches a kind of personal crisis point, even a suicidal one. And that crisis drives them toward ideology and finding ideologies on the internet or elsewhere in their lives. That in some sense, mass shootings are first and foremost about hopelessness and despair, and that leads to the bigoted ideas. What do you make of that?
I mean, it in some ways it makes sense. I had the unfortunate task of reading through the manifesto of the Buffalo shooter, but also the messages that were posted on the Discord platform. And you could see that, yes, this is actually an 18-year-old, but also that this was an anguished person who talked about suicide and seemed to be in trouble and in deep despair. And I know that it's, you know, in this country in particular, we're not supposed to talk about that. This is a hardened killer. We can't talk about him as a teenager or a child. He's a 18-year-old man. But I don't know where that takes us.
You're from Buffalo, and you must have taken this especially hard. Your dad is still there, who's a scholar, professor. What was your initial reaction to this, and how does the Buffalo-ness of this story figure into everything?
So I think my wife and son had gone out for the morning, and we'd come back in the afternoon, and we were like sitting around. I looked at my phone like we always do before we do anything or when we finish something, and the banner came across. At that point, it was 8 shot in Buffalo grocery store. You know, I thought it was unlikely that my father is not going out shopping anywhere, but for my stepmother, most certainly. And this was 1 mile from my dad's house. So there was about 5 minutes of panic where they got back in touch within 5 minutes. And then I immediately shifted course to this was a white supremacist. It was the same feeling that I had when I initially heard the Charleston shooting. I immediately thought, there is a white person involved with this. And there are many things to say about this, but I do think the fact that he wanted to find the greatest concentration of Black people that were nearest to him and was able to type that information in and quickly come to this area in Buffalo just really tells you a lot about the conditions in the city that lead to a zip code where 78% of the residents are African-American. People are angry about the way that this story is being framed, which is to say that there has been a lot of talk about, you know, we won't let this white supremacist divide our city. Buffalo's nickname is the City of Good Neighbors. And I think that people are disturbed because there's a way in which Buffalo is not a united city. Buffalo is one of the most segregated cities in the United States, meaning that, you know, Buffalo is not exactly the city of good neighbors. It might be the city of hostile neighbors.
Now, Kianga, there's no way for me to quantify this. It's an impression, and maybe you think I'm wrong. But it seemed to me that when Charleston happened, it was an enormous storm of publicity, journalism, demonstrations. President Obama, of course, went down for the funerals. I find that the Buffalo story has passed. It's almost as if racialized mass killing has become not so extraordinary.
I saw this poll this morning. 60% of Trump supporters think that the quote-unquote great replacement theory is real. The racial dynamics have dramatically changed since Charleston. But the second part of this is I think that we have become habituated to mass shootings. I remember having this sense after the Vegas shooting in 2017. It was this was massive, massive carnage. And it felt very quickly that we had moved on. Someone said it, and I can't remember who, but that once the United States sort of deemed itself powerless to respond to the mass murder of first graders in Connecticut, then what would compel a reckoning around gun violence?
Kiyanga Yamada Taylor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kiyanga Yamada Taylor is a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. And you can read her on the Buffalo attack and much more at NewYorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. I'm David Remnick, and this is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Last week, Roger Angel, the longtime fiction editor of the New Yorker, and a friend to generations of staffers at the magazine, died at home at the age of 101. As a writer, Roger took up the subject of baseball in the early 60s, just as the Mets were being born, and he was soon recognized as the greatest chronicler in the history of the game. One of the best memories I have at this magazine was sitting in the left field stands with Roger at Shea Stadium as the Yankees beat the Mets in the deciding game of the World Series in 2000, and then entering the Yankees locker room with Roger under huge plumes of champagne. Joe Torre, the Yankees manager who had known Roger since his playing days, greeted Roger like a brother. We're going to revisit now an interview I did with Roger in 2015, just a year after he was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. One of the things that always amazed me about your baseball writing is that you have a tone of a happy man, of someone who's going at this at his leisure, and that all the difficulty of writing, which we know to be the case, is somehow way out of the frame, that there is this voice of someone just in love with what he's watching. That's hard to achieve.
Well, it developed over the years. I mean, I didn't really plan it in advance. It was some kind of me.
What was the kind of sports writing that you couldn't stand? What were you trying to avoid?
Actually, when I started, Sean said...
William Sean, the editor of the magazine for decades.
My editor said, why don't you get on spring training and take a look? And he said, we don't want to be sentimental and we don't want to be a tough guys. You know, the two things to avoid.
And did Sean know anything about baseball?
Nothing. My first piece, he came into my office carrying the galleys. My first piece from that spring training, and he pointed to a page place on the page and he said, what's this? And I looked and I said, that's a double play, Bill. And he said, what's a double play? And I explained it to him, and his cheeks glowed with excitement. It was something new.
Did you find it harder to talk with players as time went by, as you got a little older? Did you gravitate more toward coaches and managers than players?
Once they call you sir, you're in big trouble.
Yeah.
I gravitated toward good talkers, as I've said before.
But did they thin out, was what I mean? Did the good talkers become less and less numerous?
Yes, I think so. It's very, I mean, when I got over 80, it was impossible for me to talk to players, really, because they would say, sir. And also, as you've said, the habit of talking openly as a person, not as a very well-paid celebrity, semi-celebrity ball player, is pretty well gone.
It's because it's a big difference when the ball players are making about as much as a solid orthodontist,
sure,
and now they're making as much as an oligarch.
Sure, but you did pay attention, as I did. I would carry notes and write endlessly, like long notes, and keep my ears open and listen for something. I remember being outside the office of Jim Frey, the Kansas City manager, after his great star George Brett had another extraordinary day at the plate. And I'm waiting to go in to see the manager, and there are two old coaches at their lockers just outside the door in their underwear and clogs talking, a couple of country guys. And one of them says to the other, everything that George hits goes through the infield like a stream of milk. And this country image, and I wrote it down. I wrote it down. Wow, thank you.
You wait days for things like that in the nonfiction game. Roger, you practiced nonfiction, as it were, by night and fiction by day. For years and years, you were the fiction editor of The New Yorker. To this day, you read short stories for us and in the fiction department. Was this bread in the bone with you? I think some of our listeners will know that your mother was really had singular responsibility for introducing serious fiction to The New Yorker. Catherine White was the person who brought real fiction to The New Yorker. And you must have grown up hearing about this process and knowing this process.
My stepfather was E.B. White, who was E.B. White and writing for the magazine every week. And my mother and stepfather's house was full of galleys and pencils and eraser rubbings and conversation about the magazine and about Harold Ross and about the writers of the day. And sure, I paid close attention, but I wasn't planning to be a New Yorker editor or to be a New Yorker writer.
What were you planning
on? I was hoping to be maybe a boy naturalist, a herpetologist was my first aim. But I did pay attention, and they were doing the same thing. And my mother was editing Vladimir Nabokov and people like that.
How did Nabokov take editing?
With his usual haughty way, and the famous Nabokov editing was by the great New Yorker founding editor Harold Ross, who loved clarity above all and was not classically or much educated, but loved clearness. And in the middle of some terrific Nabokov memoir, I think part of his Speak Memory pieces, his wonderful memories about his family, there's a line at the dinner table, and somebody says, "Pass the nutcracker." And one of Harold Ross's endless queries, he always had about 20 or 30 queries about every piece of copy, he said, "From the evidence we've been given so far, I would have assumed that the Nabokovs were a more than one nutcracker family." So...
I was looking through some letters that came to Harold Ross, and Roald Dahl, who wrote all those great children's books, but also a number of things for The New Yorker and memoir pieces for The New Yorker, wrote a scathing letter to Ross complaining about the editing and the number of commas that had been injected into things. And he says, it's as if you would take a great comma shaker and sprinkled commas throughout my
copy. Well, that was our style, it's lightened up a little bit.
Now, tell me about this new book. You've put together an enormous range of things. You've got in here some obituaries that were published in The New Yorker or online. You've got a couple of long, sustained essays that we'll talk about, some baseball writing.
Letters.
The book is called This Old Man by Roger Angel, All in Pieces.
This Old Man, Roger Angel, All in Pieces. Well, I'm a little tired of the joke and the title already.
But tell me about the book itself.
Well, I wrote the piece, This Old Man. I started the piece in 2013, I think, late in the year, and I think handed it to you along about February, something like that.
It came as a complete surprise to me. Just plopped it on my desk, done.
I wrote it in different pieces. I didn't quite know what I was doing, and it was about physical debility, and it starts off with a description of my arthritic hands, and
which you say the tips of your fingers look like they've been the subject of torture by the KGB.
If I point my forefinger at you like a pistol and fire it up for your nose, I hit you in the knee. But I describe some of the everyday debilities of age, and I didn't quite know what I was doing, but I knew that loss was at the middle of this. I had lost my wife. We were married for 48 years, and I'd lost a daughter, and a beloved dog of Carol's and mine went out the fifth floor window in the middle of jumped out the window on the fifth floor and was killed. Losses for people my age are common. Ed Hirsch, the wonderful poet, lost his son and wrote a great book about it last year. And he says that anybody over the age of 65 has a 100-pound bag of cement of loss on his shoulders. And he writes about writing about the loss of his son and said to the, he says, you can't make a story out of it. You can't do that with a life. So I didn't know how to touch on these subjects, and I didn't know if I wanted to even. And I did so actually through the loss of the dog. And I'd written a piece about losing my wife, losing Carol, called Over the Wall, which sort of began this process. And I waited 6 months. And just after the first Obama election, she died in April. And I said she didn't know this news, and she didn't know about the hurricane that fall and a lot of things she didn't know. And I said, the dead don't know what's happening, and the dead leave quickly. And I quoted a Kenneth Koch poem, say, les morts vont vite, the dead go quickly. And there's a line in that which says, no more scenes in the bedroom, no more waiting in the hall, waiting to say hello with mixed feelings. Perfect line. I described the death of Harry, this dog, and then threw in that Carol and I wept. We couldn't get over weeping for him. And he lay in our bathroom between us on the floor, and we threw Kleenex back and forth. And I said we were also weeping for my daughter Callie, who had committed suicide a couple of years earlier, and events that we knew we couldn't just get our minds around in any way, but it was for both. But I don't want to dwell on this. I didn't want to make much of this because everybody's experienced loss. And there are many changes of mood through this piece. I patched the thing together, and some of the sadder or little moments, paragraphs that are hard to take are often followed by a joke or a lighter moment. And there are some actual jokes in there, and is okay because I like to take jokes. I count on jokes myself. I'm known to tell jokes.
And there's also the opposite of loss. There's new love.
Yes, and this was happening. I was finding someone new in my life, my present wife, Peggy, and this was going on,
and
I wanted to say that, and time was going by, and I was still engaged in life, and I said that old people are like everyone else. We need connection. We need love. We need intimate love.
And a hand on the shoulder. I mean, there's sex. I mean, the piece ends with, in a sense, life against all other things.
Against all odds. Against all odds, yes. But I wanted to say what was happening with me, which happens with other old people. Old people fall in love. Old people have love life, have intimate connections, have sex lives. And people don't like to admit this, mostly their children. But
because they're somehow revolted by it.
But I think people are getting over this because it's now known. I mean, it's not something to be repelled by. It's something to be grateful for. This brings up something else, which I've noticed with writers that I've dealt with. Writers that go on and on often go back, as Updike did, go back to the same subjects again and again. He went back to his mother, to the sandstone field farmhouse, to his father, to his teenage courting years, and did the same story really again and again, but much better each time with increased feeling. Some of the very best stories he wrote for us were at the very end. And the same thing happened with another writer of mine that I edited over a period of 40 years, V.S. Pritchett, the great British writer. In his middle 80s, suddenly he got on this amazing hot streak writing some of the greatest stories of his life. And I think that all of us do this at any age because we basically go over the same material in our minds again and again, the stories that really mean a lot to us. And it's not we're trying to get them right, but we're not trying to change the outcome, but we're trying to keep them or to say, was this the way it was? And psychologists and experts on the subject say that this is what memory is. It isn't just a defensive thing to protect us from falling out of a tree when the tiger's passing by, but it is a trying out of a scenario again and again because it may be of use. That's what memory is. And this is why the same scenes recur. After I wrote scenes, a lot of this personal stuff I used to have dreams about or think about over, and once I put them down and get them published, I don't think about them anymore. It's very strange. It goes away.
When you go back and read your earlier stuff, do you recognize it? Does it feel like you?
Not the very early stuff. No, it feels like Hemingway.
And can you relate it all to a decision like Philip Roth's to stop writing?
Well, I haven't got there yet. I'm thinking of not blogging anymore because I don't think it's my blogs are quite up to what they were. But
I'll be the judge of that. Right. Keep going. Well, please.
No,
keep
I don't.
Going.
I don't want to stop. I like to have it still going on a little bit. And then this way, once again, I think I'm extremely lucky. I'm 95 and still writing. My goodness. I mean, I'm startled and very happy.
I'm happy to be here with you always, Roger. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you, David.
Roger Angel, who died last week at 101. Our love and condolences to Roger's wife, Peggy Moorman, and to all of his family and friends. We'll be back in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
It's about 9 a.m., light drizzle. We're on the banks of the Hudson River on a little park, and the striped bass are running, so we're going to try to hook some fish.
Breida Green is one of our producers, and on a Monday morning recently, she was in the town of Beacon, New York. Now, I happen to do what little fishing I do on vacation, but not on company time. And in fairness, Breida wasn't just having fun. She was there to meet Karen Chi. Chi is a comedy writer, and she works for Late Night with Seth Meyers. She's a contributor to the New Yorker's humor column, too. And she's also a recent but enthusiastic convert to the great sport of fishing.
Maybe even a couple of years ago, if somebody had been like, do you want to go fish for 2 hours? I'd be like, what a waste of time. Like, I have stuff to do. But now it just makes the rest of my day so much better. And I'm always in a much better mood after I've spaced out and zoned out for a while.
So we could sort of climb down on the rocks over there. Yeah. But it's a little shallow.
Okay. I will say, of all the times I've gone fishing, I think I've only caught a fish once.
Really?
Yeah, and I'm sort of afraid of catching a fish, but I love the anticipation of it could happen. Yum! I got this worm, I cut it in half, and I'm sort of hooking it on to the hook. I'm putting it on a few times so that it won't fall off immediately in the water. Okay, and then I'm gonna walk the bail. And yeah, we'll see how it goes.
Chi grew up in California in the Bay Area, and she took up fishing during the pandemic on an extended visit to South Korea.
Before the pandemic hit, I was writing for Late Night and doing stand-up pretty much every night. And that was kind of the routine I had settled into. So then when the pandemic hit, it was remote work and no live shows. And Zoom made me really anxious, so I just sort of stopped doing stand-up altogether for a while.
Wow. And you were in New York?
I was in New York. I was in a little apartment with two other people and a cat. And we were indoors for like 2 full months. Yeah.
Oh,
it was
wild. And then what happens that made you decide to move to Korea?
So I went because my grandma got really sick quite suddenly. And I went thinking I would be there for a month or two. So I brought like 5 t-shirts, and that was like all I had brought. I brought like a small suitcase of summer clothes.
Can you ask what happened?
Yeah, she's actually doing much better now, but she had heart failure, and also she's 92, so it was just so many other things weren't going well, you know?
Scary.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what made you stay?
Well, she didn't get better for a really long time, and because it was remote work, I was like, I'll stay there, it's no problem. And maybe it's also because of the pandemic and how much, you know, life-threatening and scary that was for people, even if it was just in the abstract. And, yeah, when my grandma got sick, it felt like the equivalent of people, you know, when they have babies and they're like, suddenly all my priorities, you know, lined up. And that's how I felt.
Wow. And because you would work nights because you were working, like, U.S. hours?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was crazy. I would be writing jokes at like 2 a.m. about the Trump administration. At nighttime, the silver lining of that schedule was that the first few months, we needed to have somebody awake throughout the night to check on my grandma periodically to make sure she was breathing okay, and also to help her go to the bathroom. I was like, oh, I'll do night duty because I'm up working anyway. And so that coincided really nicely. Oh, wait, hold on. I'm getting a pull. I wonder if it got stuck, though. Let's see. I'm holding it at a 45-degree angle.
Do you think it's just, like, hooked under there?
I would love if you pulled this out and there's just, like, a whale.
And we're like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Maybe, like, a trash bin.
It's actually, the pull is gone, so I wonder... Let's just reel it back. Interesting. Oop. There's the worm! Okay, we can try it again. I mean, it's gonna become very clear that I just fish for... to go through the motions of fishing rather than survival. I started fishing because, well, a mix of all of the stress things I mentioned, but I read, this is going to sound nerdy, but I read How to Do Nothing by Jenny Odell, and I was like, I got to find a hobby where I'm not thinking about anything, and I'm not thinking about work. In Korean, there's like a word called like, I'm just going to say it in Korean, it's mongterinda, which is spacing out. And so you can like, mongterio in any place, but you can also do, people really like doing this thing called like mongbul or pulmong, which is you space out while looking at a fire, that sort of a thing. And so I was like, okay, I'm gonna do this while I'm fishing. And so there's like a sort of an overpass by the Han River, which is the river that like sort of cleaves through Seoul, so it splits the city in two. And yeah, I saw, it's like a lot of old men fishing silently next to each other, and I kind of just joined them, so it was very nice. We didn't talk at all, but one of them was actually very helpful with like helping me figure out how to get the line right and how to cast and everything, but was very gruff the entire time, which I thought was so charming.
Wow, so you just like cast in, and then you just stand there, and you just try to like clear your mind?
Yeah, I truly just zone out.
It's like a meditation.
I guess so. When I've tried meditating before and I always fall asleep. So this is a nice way to be a little bit alert. There's like a little bit of anticipation with the fish and then I can completely chill out, which is nice. Oh no, it's tangled. Here we go, okay. I definitely thought the pandemic would be more temporary than it is, and I thought there would be a clear end date and that my life would resume, but I actually think the way I sort of think about my life has completely changed since then. I just want to make sure I always have enough time to spend with my family and friends, and that that is more important to me than work. Yeah, so I think fishing is probably going to stick around for a bit. My dream is to have a fishing buddy who also, we can just sit in silence for a couple hours and be like, yeah, let's go home. We go home.
That's Karen Chi out on the Hudson River with Breida Green of the Radio Hour.
Wow, we didn't catch anything.
That's okay.
Do you feel relieved?
I do. It's very much a journey, not the destination type of activity.
She is a contributor to the New Yorker's Shouts and Murmurs column, and she writes for Late Night with Seth Meyers. She's working on season 2 of Pachinko for Apple TV. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. And if you're out fishing this weekend, I hope you have better luck than I did last week. I'm David Remnick. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.